Book 1. Chapter 1. They were living at Le Gros du Roi then, and the hotel was on a canal that ran from the walled city of Aigues-Mortes straight down to the sea. They could see the towers of Aigues-Mortes across the low plain of the Camargue, and they rode there on their bicycles at some time of nearly every day along the white road that bordered the canal. In the evenings and the mornings, when there was a rising tide, sea bass would come into it, and they would see the mullet jumping wildly to escape from the bass, and watch the swelling bulge of the water as the bass attacked. A jetty ran out into the blue and pleasant sea, and they fished from the jetty and swam on the beach, and each day helped the fishermen haul in the long net that brought the fish up onto the long sloping beach. They drank aperitifs in the café on the corner facing the sea, and watched the sails of the mackerel fishing boats out in the Gulf of Lions. It was late in the spring, and the mackerel were running, and fishing people of the port were very busy. It was a cheerful and friendly town, and the young couple liked the hotel, which had four rooms upstairs and a restaurant and two billiard tables downstairs facing the canal and the lighthouse. The room they lived in looked like the painting of Van Gogh's room at Arles, except there was a double bed and two big windows, and you could look out across the water and the marsh and sea meadows to the white town and bright beach of Palavas. They were always hungry, but they ate very well. They were hungry for breakfast, which they ate at the café, ordering brioche and café au lait and eggs, and the type of preserve that they chose and the manner in which the eggs were to be cooked was an excitement. They were always so hungry for breakfast that the girl often had a headache until the coffee came. But the coffee took the headache away. She took her coffee without sugar, and the young man was learning to remember that. On this morning, there was brioche and red raspberry preserve, and the eggs were boiled, and there was a pat of butter that melted as they stirred them and salted them lightly and ground pepper over them in the cups. They were big eggs and fresh, and the girls were not cooked quite as long as the young man's. He remembered that easily, and he was happy with his, which he diced up with the spoon and ate with only the flow of butter to moisten them, and the fresh early morning texture and the bite of the coarsely ground pepper grains and the hot coffee and the chicory fragrant bowl of café au lait. The fishing boats were well out. They had gone out in the dark with the first rising of the breeze, and the young man and the girl had wakened and heard them, and then curled together under the sheet of the bed and slept again. They had made love when they were half awake, with the light bright outside, but the room still shadowed, and then had lain together and been happy and tired and then made love again. Then they were so hungry that they did not think they would live until breakfast, and now they were in the café eating and watching the sea and the sails, and it was a new day again.
"What are you thinking?" the girl asked.
"Nothing."
"You have to think something."
"I was just feeling."
"How?"
"Happy."
"But I get so hungry," she said. "Is it normal, do you think? Do you always get so hungry when you make love?"
"When you love somebody."
"Oh, you know too much about it," she said.
"No."
"I don't care. I love it, and we don't have to worry about anything, do we?"
"Nothing."
"What do you think we should do?"
"I don't know," he said. "What do you?"
"I don't care at all. If you'd like to fish, I should write a letter or maybe two, and then we could swim before lunch."
"To be hungry?"
"Don't say it. I'm getting hungry already, and we haven't finished breakfast."
"We can think about lunch."
"And then after lunch?"
"We'll take a nap, like good children."
"That's an absolutely new idea," she said. "Why have we never thought of that?"
"I have these flashes of intuition," he said. "I'm the inventive type."
"I'm the destructive type," she said, "and I'm going to destroy you. They'll put a plaque up on the wall of the building outside the room. I'm going to wake up in the night and do something to you that you've never even heard of or imagined."
"I was going to last night, but I was too sleepy."
"You're too sleepy to be dangerous. Don't lull yourself into any false security. Oh, darling, let's have it hurry up and be lunchtime."
They sat there in their striped fisherman shirts and the shorts they had bought in the store that sold marine supplies, and they were very tan, and their hair was streaked and faded by the sun and the sea.
Most people thought they were brother and sister until they said they were married. Some did not believe that they were married, and that pleased the girl very much. In those years, only a very few people had ever come to the Mediterranean in the summertime, and no one came to Le Gros du Roi except a few people from Nîmes. There was no casino and no entertainment, and except in the hottest months when people came to swim, there was no one at the hotel. People did not wear fisherman shirts then, and this girl that he was married to was the first girl he had ever seen wearing one. She had bought the shirts for them and then had washed them in the basin in their room at the hotel to take the stiffness out of them. They were stiff and built for hard wear, but the washing softened them. And now they were worn and softened enough so that when he looked at the girl now, her breast showed beautifully against the worn cloth. No one wore shorts either around the village, and the girl could not wear them when they rode their bicycles. But in the village it did not matter because the people were very friendly, and only the local priest disapproved. But the girl went to Mass on Sunday wearing a skirt and a long-sleeved cashmere sweater with her hair covered with a scarf, and the young man stood in the back of the church with the men. They gave 20 francs, which was more than a dollar then, and since the priest took up the collection himself, their attitude toward the church was known, and the wearing of shorts in the village was regarded as an eccentricity by foreigners, rather than an attempt against the morality of the ports of the Camargue. The priest did not speak to them when they wore shorts, but he did not denounce them, and when they wore trousers in the evening, the three of them bowed to each other.
"I'll go up and write the letters," the girl said, and she got up and smiled at the waiter and went out of the cafe.
"Monsieur is going to fish?" the waiter asked, when the young man, whose name was David Bourne, called him over and paid him.
"I think so. How's the tide?"
"This tide is very good," the waiter said. "I have some bait if you want it."
"I can get some along the road."
"No, use this. There are sandworms and there are plenty."
"Can you come out?"
"I'm on duty now, but maybe I can come out and see how you do. You have your gear?"
"It's at the hotel."
"Stop by for the worms."
At the hotel, the young man wanted to go up to the room and see the girl, but instead he found the long, jointed bamboo pole and the basket with his fishing gear behind the desk where the room keys hung, and went back out into the brightness of the road and on down to the cafe and out onto the glare of the jetty. The sun was hot, but there was a fresh breeze and the tide was just starting to ebb. He wished that he had brought a casting rod and spoons so that he might cast out across the flow of the water from the canal, over the rocks on the far side. But instead he rigged his long pole with its cork and quill float and let a sandworm float gently along at a depth where he thought fish might be feeding. He fished for some time with no luck and watched the mackerel boats tacking back and forth out on the blue sea and the shadows the high clouds made on the water. Then his float went under in a sharp descent with the line angling stiffly, and he brought the pole up against the pull of a fish that was strong and driving wildly and making the line hiss through the water. He tried to hold it as lightly as he could, and the long pole was bent to the breaking point of the line and trace by the fish which kept trying to go toward the open sea. The young man walked with him on the jetty to ease the strain, but the fish kept pulling so that as he drove, a quarter of the rod was forced underwater. The waiter had come from the cafe and was very excited. He was talking by the young man's side, saying,
"Hold him, hold him, hold him as softly as you can. He'll have to tire. Don't let him break. Soft with him. Softly. Softly."
There was no way the young man could be softer with him except to get into the water with the fish, and that did not make sense as the canal was deep.
"If I could only walk along the bank with him," he thought. But they had come to the very end of the jetty. More than half the pole was underwater now.
"Just hold him softly," the waiter pleaded. "It's a strong trace."
The fish bored deep, ran, zigzagged, and the long bamboo pole bent with his weight and his rapid driving strength. Then he came up thrashing at the surface, and then was down again, and the young man found that although the fish felt as strong as ever, the tragic violence was lessened, and now he could be led around the end of the jetty and up the canal.
"Softly does it," the waiter said. "Oh, softly now, softly for us all."
Twice more the fish forced his way out to the open sea, and twice the young man led him back, and now he was leading him gently along the jetty toward the cafe.
"How is he?" asked the waiter.
"He's fine, but we've beaten him."
"Don't say it," the waiter said. "Don't say it. We must tire him. Tire him, tire him."
"He's got my arm tired," the young man said.
"Do you want me to take him?"
the waiter asked, hopefully. "My God, no."
"Just easy, easy, easy. Softly, softly, softly," the waiter said.
The young man worked the fish past the terrace of the cafe and into the canal. He was swimming just under the surface, but was still strong, and the young man wondered if they could take him all the way up the canal through the length of the town. There were many other people now, and as they went by the hotel, the girl saw them out of the window and shouted,
"Oh, what a wonderful fish! Wait for me! Wait for me!"
She had seen the fish clearly from above, and his length and the shine of him in the water, and her husband with the bamboo pole bent almost double, and the procession of people following. When she got down to the canal bank and, running, caught up with the people, the procession had stopped. The waiter was in the water at the edge of the canal, and her husband was guiding the fish slowly against the bank where there was a clump of weeds growing. The fish was on the surface now, and the waiter bent down and brought his hands together from either side and then lifted the fish with his thumbs in both his gills and moved up the bank of the canal with him. He was a heavy fish, and the waiter held him against his chest with the head under his chin and the tail flopping against his thighs. Several men were pounding the young man on the back and putting their arms around him, and a woman from the fish market kissed him. Then the girl had her arms around him and kissed him, and he said, "Did you see him?" Then they all went over to see him laid out on the side of the road, silver as a salmon and dark gunmetal shining on his back. He was a handsome, beautifully built fish with great live eyes, and he breathed slowly and brokenly.
"What is he?"
"A loo," he said. "That's a sea bass. They call them bar, too. They're a wonderful fish. This is the biggest one I've ever seen." The waiter, whose name was Andre, came over and put his arms around David and kissed him, and then he kissed the girl.
"Madame, it is necessary," he said. "It is truly necessary. No one ever caught such a fish on such tackle."
"We better have him weighed," David said. They were at the cafe now. The young man had put the tackle away after the weighing and washed up, and the fish was on a block of ice that had come in the camion from Nîmes to ice the mackerel catch. The fish had weighed a little over 15 pounds. On the ice he was still silver and beautiful, but the color on his back had changed to gray. Only his eyes still looked alive. The mackerel fishing boats were coming in now, and the women were unloading the shining blue and green and silver mackerel from the boats into baskets and carrying the heavy baskets on their heads to the fish house. It was a very good catch, and the town was busy and happy.
"What are we going to do with the big fish?" the girl asked.
"They're going to take him in and sell him," the young man said. "He's too big to cook here, and they said it would be wicked to cut him up. Maybe he'll go right up to Paris. He'll end up in some big restaurant, or somebody very rich will buy him."
"He was so beautiful in the water," she said. "And when Andre held him up, I couldn't believe him when I saw him out of the window, and you with your mob following you.
We'll get a small one for us to eat. They're really wonderful. A small one ought to be grilled with butter and with herbs. They're like striped bass at home."
"I'm excited about the fish," she said. "Don't we have wonderful, simple fun?"
They were hungry for lunch, and the bottle of white wine was cold, and they drank it as they ate the celery remoulade and the small radishes and the home-pickled mushrooms from the big glass jar. The bass was grilled, and the grill marks showed on the silver skin, and the butter melted on the hot plate. There was sliced lemon to press on the bass and fresh bread from the bakery, and the wine cooled their tongues of the heat of the fried potatoes. It was good, light, dry, cheerful, unknown white wine, and the restaurant was proud of it.
"We're not great conversationalists at meals," the girl said. "Do I bore you, darling?"
The young man laughed.
"Don't laugh at me, David."
"I wasn't. No, you don't bore me. I'd be happy looking at you if you never said a word. He poured her another small glass of the wine and filled his own.
I have a big surprise.
I didn't tell you, did I? The girl said.
What sort of surprise?
Oh, it's very simple, but it's very complicated.
Tell me.
No. You might like it, and maybe you couldn't stand it.
It sounds too dangerous.
It's dangerous, she said. But don't ask me. I'm going up to the room, if I may.
The young man paid for the lunch and drank the wine that was left in the bottle. Then he went upstairs. The girl's clothes were folded on one of the Van Gogh chairs, and she was waiting for him in the bed with the sheet over her. Her hair was spread out over the pillow, and her eyes were laughing, and he lifted the sheet, and she said,
"Hello, darling. Did you have a nice lunch?"
Afterwards, they lay together with his arm under her head, and were happy and lazy, and he felt her head turn from side to side and stroke it against his cheek. It felt silky and barely roughened from the sun and the sea. Then with her hair all forward over her face so it touched him as her head moved, she started to play with him lightly and exploringly, and then with delight, and she said,
"You do love me, don't you?"
He nodded and kissed the top of her head, and then turned her head and held it and kissed her lips.
"Oh," she said. "Oh."
A long time later they were lying, each holding the other close, and she said,
"And you love me just the way I am? You're sure?"
"Yes," he said, "so much yes."
"Because I'm going to be changed."
"No," he said, "no, not changed."
"I'm going to," she said. "It's for you. It's for me, too. I won't pretend it's not, but it will do something to you. I'm sure, but I shouldn't say it. I like surprises, but I like everything the way it is just now at this minute." "Then maybe I shouldn't do it," she said. "Oh, I'm sad. It was such a wonderful, dangerous surprise. I thought about it for days, and I didn't decide until this morning."
"If it's something you really want."
"It is," she said, "and I'm going to do it. You've liked everything we've done so far, haven't you?"
"Yes."
"All right."
She slipped out of bed and stood straight with her long brown legs and her beautiful body tanned evenly from the far beach where they swam without suits. She held her shoulders back and her chin up, and she shook her head so heavy, tawny hair slapped around her cheeks, and then bowed forward so it all fell forward and covered her face. She pulled the striped shirt over her head, and then shook her hair back, and then sat in the chair in front of the mirror on the dresser and brushed it back, looking at it critically. It fell to the top of her shoulders. She shook her head at the mirror. Then she pulled on her slacks and belted them, and put on her faded blue rope-soled shoes.
"I have to ride up to Egmort," she said.
"Good," he said. "I'll come too."
"No, I have to go alone. It's about the surprise."
She kissed him goodbye and went down, and he watched her mount her bicycle and go up the road, riding smoothly and easily, her hair blowing in the wind. The afternoon sun was in the window now, and the room was too warm. The young man washed and put on his clothes and went down to walk on the beach. He knew he should swim, but he was tired, and after he had walked along the beach and then along a path through the salt grass that led inland for a way, he went back along the beach to the port and climbed up to the café. In the café, he found the paper and ordered himself a fin à l'eau, because he felt empty and hollow from making love. They had been married 3 weeks and had come down on the train from Paris to Avignon with their bicycles, a suitcase with their town clothes, and a rucksack and a musette bag. They stayed at a good hotel in Avignon and left the suitcase there and had thought that they would ride to the Pont du Gard. But the Mistral was blowing, so they rode with the Mistral down to Nîmes and stayed there at the Imperator, and then had ridden down to Egmort still with the heavy wind behind them, and then on to Le Gros du Roi. They had been there ever since. It had been wonderful, and they had been truly happy, and he had not known that you could love anyone so much that you cared about nothing else, and other things seemed inexistent. He had many problems when he married, but he had thought of none of them here, nor of writing, nor of anything but being with this girl
whom he loved and was married to, and he did not have the sudden, deadly clarity that had always come after intercourse. That was gone. Now, when they had made love, they would eat and drink and make love again. It was a very simple world, and he had never been truly happy in any other. He thought that it must be the same with her, and certainly she acted in that way. But today there had been this thing about the change and the surprise. But maybe it would be a happy change and a good surprise. The brandy and water as he drank it and read the local paper made him look forward to whatever it was. This was the first time since they had come on the wedding trip that he had taken a drink of brandy or whiskey when they were not together. But he was not working, and his only rules about drinking were never to drink before or while he was working. It would be good to work again, but that would come soon enough, as he well knew, and he must remember to be unselfish about it, and make it as clear as he could that the enforced loneliness was regrettable, and that he was not proud of it. He was sure she would be fine about it, and she had her own resources, but he hated to think of it, the work, starting when they were as they were now. It can never start, of course, without the clarity, and he wondered if she knew that, and if that was why she drove beyond what they had for something new that nothing could break. But what could it be? They could not be held tighter together than they were now, and there was no badness afterwards. There was only happiness and loving each other, and then hunger and replenishing and starting over. He found that he had drunk the Finalo and that it was getting late in the afternoon. He ordered another and started to concentrate on the paper. But the paper did not interest him as it should, and he was looking out at the sea with late afternoon sun heavy on it, when he heard her come into the cafe and say in her throaty voice, "Hello, darling." She came quickly to the table and sat down and lifted her chin and looked at him with the laughing eyes and the golden face with the tiny freckles. Her hair was cropped as short as a boy's. It was cut with no compromises. It was brushed back, heavy as always, but the sides were cut short and the ears that grew close to her head were clear, and the tawny line of her hair was cropped close to her head and smooth and sweeping back. She turned her head and lifted her breasts and said, "Kiss me, please." He kissed her and looked at her face and at her hair, and he kissed her again. "Do you like it? Feel it how smooth, feel it in the back," she said. He felt it in back. "Feel on my cheek and feel in front of my ear. Run your fingers up at the sides." "You see," she said, "that's the surprise. I'm a girl, but now I'm a boy too, and I can do anything and anything and anything." "Sit here by me," he said. "What do you want, brother?" "Oh, thank you," she said. "I'll take what you're having. You see why it's dangerous, don't you?"
"Yes, I see."
"But wasn't I good to do it?"
"Maybe."
"Not maybe, no. I thought about it. I thought all about it. Why do we have to go by everyone else's rules? We're us."
"We were having a good time and I didn't feel any rules."
"Would you please just put your hand over it again?"
He did, and he kissed her.
"Oh, you're sweet," she said, "and you do like it. I can feel and I can tell. You don't have to love it, just like it at first."
"I like it," he said, "and you have such a beautifully shaped head that it is very beautiful with the lovely bones of your face."
"Well, don't you like it at the sides?" she asked. "It isn't faked or phony. It's a true boy's haircut, and not from any beauty shop."
"Who cut it?"
"The coiffeur at Egmort. The one who cut your hair a week ago. You told him how you wanted yours cut, and then I told him to cut mine just the same as yours. He was very nice and wasn't at all surprised. He wasn't worried at all. He said, 'Exactly like yours?' And I said, 'Exactly.' Doesn't it do anything to you, David?"
"Yes," he said.
"Stupid people will think it is strange, but we must be proud. I love to be proud."
"So do I," he said. "We'll start being proud now." They sat there in the cafe and watched the reflection of the setting sun over the water and watched the dusk come to the town, and they drank the Finalo. People came by the cafe without being rude to see the girl because they had been the only foreigners in the village and had been there now for nearly 3 weeks, and she was a great beauty and they liked her. Then there had been the big fish today, and ordinarily there would have been much talk about that, but this other was a big thing in the village too. No decent girls had ever had their hair cut short like that in this part of the country, and even in Paris it was rare and strange, and could be beautiful or could be very bad. It could mean too much, or it could only mean showing the beautiful shape of a head that could never be shown as well. They ate a steak for dinner, rare, with mashed potatoes and flageolet and a salad, and the girl asked if they might drink Tavel.
It is a great wine for people that are in love, she said.
She had always looked, he thought, exactly her age, which was now 21. He had been very proud of her for that. But tonight she did not look it. The lines of her cheekbones showed clear as he had never seen them before, and she smiled and her face was heartbreaking. In the room it was dark, with only a little light from outside. It was cool now with the breeze, and the top sheet was gone from the bed.
Dave, you don't mind if we've gone to the devil, do you?
No, girl, he said.
Don't call me girl.
Or I'm holding you, you are a girl, he said. He held her tight around her breasts, and he opened and closed his fingers, feeling her, and the hard, erect freshness between his fingers.
They're just my dowry, she said. The new is my surprise. Feel. No, leave them. They'll be there. Feel my cheeks and the back of my neck. Oh, it feels so wonderful and good and clean and new. Please love me, David, the way I am. Please understand and love me.
He had shut his eyes, and he could feel the long, light weight of her on him, and her breasts pressing against him and her lips on his. He lay there and felt something, and then her hand holding him and searching lower. And he helped with his hands, and then lay back in the dark and did not think at all, and only felt the weight and the strangeness inside, and she said,
Now you can't tell who is who, can you?
No.
You are changing, she said. Oh, you are. You are. Yes, you are. And you're my girl, Catherine. Will you change and be my girl and let me take you?
You're Catherine.
No, I'm Peter. You're my wonderful Catherine. You're my beautiful, lovely Catherine. You were so good to change. Oh, thank you, Catherine, so much. Please understand. Please know and understand. I'm going to make love to you forever.
At the end, they were both dead and empty, but it was not over. They lay side by side in the dark with their legs touching, and her head was on his arm. The moon had risen, and there was a little more light in the room. She ran her hand exploringly down over his belly without looking and said,
You don't think I'm wicked?
Of course not.
But how long have you thought about that? Not all the time, but quite a lot. You were so wonderful to let it happen.
The young man put his arms around the girl and held her very tight to him and felt her lovely breasts against his chest and kissed her on her dear mouth. He held her close and hard, and inside himself he said goodbye, and then goodbye, and goodbye. Let's lie very still and quiet and hold each other and not think at all, he said. And his heart said goodbye, Catherine. Goodbye, my lovely girl, goodbye, and good luck, and goodbye. Chapter 2. He stood up and looked up and down the beach, corked the bottle of oil and put it in a side pocket of the rucksack, and then walked down to the sea, feeling the sand grow cool under his feet. He looked at the girl on her back on the sloping beach, her eyes closed, her arms against her sides, and behind her the slanted square of canvas and the first tufts of beach grass. She ought not to stay too long in that position with the sun straight up and down on her, he thought. Then he walked out and dove flat into the clear, cold water and turned on his back and swam backstroke out to sea, watching the beach beyond the steady beat of his legs and feet. He turned in the water and swam down to the bottom and touched the coarse sand and felt the heavy ridges of it, and then came up to the surface and swam steadily in, seeing how slow he could keep the beat of his crawl. He walked up to the girl and saw that she was asleep. He found his wristwatch in the rucksack to check the time when he should wake her. There was a cold bottle of white wine wrapped in a newspaper and with their towels around it. He uncorked it without removing the paper or the towels and took a cool draft from the awkward bundle. Then he sat down to watch the girl and to look out to sea. This sea was always colder than it looked, he thought. It did not really warm until the middle of the summer, except on the shallow beaches. This beach dropped off quite suddenly, and the water had been sharply cold until the swimming warmed him. He looked out at the sea and the high clouds, and noticed how far the fishing fleet was working to the westward. Then he looked at the girl sleeping on the sand that was quite dry now, and beginning to blow delicately with the rising wind when his feet stirred. During the night he had felt her hands touching him, and when he woke it was in the moonlight, and she had made the dark magic of the change again, and did not say no when she spoke to him and asked the questions, and he felt the change so that it hurt him all through, and when it was finished, after they were both exhausted, she was shaking, and she whispered to him,
"Now we have done it. Now we have really done it."
Yes, he thought. Now we have really done it. And when she went to sleep suddenly like a tired young girl and lay beside him lovely in the moonlight that showed the beautiful new strange line of her head as she slept on her side, he leaned over and said to her, but not aloud,
"I'm with you. No matter what else you have in your head, I'm with you and I love you."
In the morning he had been very hungry for breakfast, but he waited for her to wake. He kissed her finally, and she woke and smiled and got up sleepily and washed in the big basin and slouched in front of the mirror of the armoire and brushed her hair and looked at the mirror unsmiling, and then smiled and touched her cheeks with the tips of her fingers and pulled a striped shirt over her head and then kissed him. She stood straight so her breasts pushed against his chest, and she said,
"Don't worry, David. I'm your good girl come back again."
But he was very worried now, and he thought, "What will become of us if things have gone this wildly and this dangerously and this fast? What can there be that will not burn out in a fire that rages like that? We were happy, and I'm sure she was happy. But whoever knows? And who are you to judge? And who participated, and who accepted the change and lived it? If that is what she wants, who are you not to wish her to have it? You're lucky to have a wife like her. And a sin is what you feel bad after, and you don't feel bad. Not with the wine you don't feel bad," he told himself. "And what will you drink when the wine won't cover for you?" He took the bottle of oil out of the rucksack and put a little oil on the girl's chin and on her cheeks and on her nose, and found a blue faded patterned handkerchief in the canvas pocket of the rucksack and laid it across her breast.
"Must I stop?" the girl asked. "I'm having the most wonderful dream."
"Finish the dream," he said.
"Thank you."
In a few minutes she breathed very deeply and shook her head and sat up.
"Let's go in now," she said.
They went in together and swam out and then played underwater like porpoises. When they swam in, they dried each other off with towels, and he handed her the bottle of wine that was still cool in the rolled newspaper, and they each took a drink, and she looked at him and laughed.
"It's nice to drink it for thirst," she said. "You don't really mind being brothers, do you?"
"No." He touched her forehead and her nose and then her cheeks and chin with the oil, and then put it carefully above and behind her ears.
"I want to get behind my ears and neck tanned and over my cheekbones, all the new places."
"You're awfully dark, brother," he said. "You don't know how dark."
"I like it," the girl said, "but I want to be darker."
They lay on the beach on the firm sand that was dry now but still cool after the high tide had fallen. The young man put some oil on the palm of his hand and spread it lightly with his fingers over the girl's thighs, and they glowed warm as the skin took the oil. He went on spreading it over her belly and breasts, and the girl said sleepily,
"We don't look very much like brothers when we're this way, do we?"
"No."
"I'm trying to be such a very good girl," she said. "Truly, you don't have to worry, darling, until night. We won't let the night things come in the day."
At the hotel, the postman was having a drink while he waited for the girl to sign for a large forwarding envelope heavy with enclosed letters from her bank in Paris. There were three letters readdressed from his bank, too. It was the first mail since they had sent the hotel as a forwarding address. The young man gave the postman 5 francs and asked him to have another glass of wine with him at the zinc bar. The girl unhooked the key from the board and said,
"I'll go up to the room and get cleaned up and meet you at the cafe."
After he finished his glass, he said goodbye to the postman and walked down along the canal to the cafe. It was good to sit in the shade after walking back bareheaded in the sun from the far beach, and it was pleasant and cool in the cafe. He ordered a vermouth and soda and took out his pocket knife and slit open his letters. All 3 envelopes were from his publishers, and 2 of them were fat with clippings and the proofs of advertisements. He glanced at the clippings and then read the long letter. It was cheerful and guardedly optimistic. It was too early to tell how the book would do, but everything looked good. Most of the reviews were excellent. Of course, there were some, but that was to be expected. Sentences had to be underlined in the reviews that would probably be used in future advertisements. His publisher wished he could say more about how the book would do, but he never made predictions as to sales. It was bad practice. The point was that the book could not have been better received. The reception was sensational, really. But he would see the clippings. The first printing had been 5,000 copies, and on the strength of the reviews, a second printing had been ordered. The upcoming advertisements would carry the phrase, "Now and its second printing." His publisher hoped that he was as happy as he deserved to be, and taking the rest that he so richly deserved, he sent his best greetings to his wife. The young man borrowed a pencil from the waiter and commenced to multiply $2.50 by 1,000. That was easy. 10% of that was $250. 5 times that was $1,250. Deduct $750 for the advance. That left $500 earned by the first printing. Now there was the second printing. Say that was 2,000. That was 12.5% of $5,000, if that was how the contract was. That would be $625. But maybe it did not go up to 12.5% until 10,000. Well, it was still $500. That would still leave 1,000. He started to read the reviews and found that he had drunk the vermouth without ever noticing it. He ordered another and returned the pencil to the waiter. He was still reading the reviews when the girl came in bringing her heavy envelope of letters.
"I didn't know they'd come," she said. "Let me see them. Please let me see them."
The waiter brought her a vermouth and, putting it down, saw the picture as the girl unfolded a clipping.
"C'est monsieur?" he asked.
"Yes, it is," the girl said, and held it up for him to see.
"But differently dressed," the waiter said. "Do they write about the marriage? May I see a picture of madame?"
"Not about the marriage. Criticisms of a book by monsieur."
"Magnificent," said the waiter, who was deeply moved. "Is madame also a writer?"
"No," the girl said, not looking up from the clippings. "Madame is a housewife." The waiter laughed proudly.
"Madame is probably in the cinema."
They both read clippings, and then the girl put the one she was reading down and said,
"I'm frightened by them and all the things they say. How can we be us and have the things we have and do what we do, and you be this that's in the clippings?"
"I've had them before," the young man said. "They're bad for you, but it doesn't last."
"They're terrible," she said. "They could destroy you if you thought about them or believed them. You don't think I married you because you are what they say you are in these clippings, do you?"
"No. I want to read them, and then we'll seal them up in the envelope."
"I know you have to read them. I don't want to be stupid about them. But even in an envelope, it's awful to have them with us. It's like bringing along somebody's ashes in a jar."
"Plenty of people would be happy if their damned husbands had good reviews."
"I'm not plenty of people, and you're not my damned husband. I know I'm a violent girl, and you're violent, too. Please, let's not fight. You read them, and if there's anything good, you tell me. And if they say anything about the book that's intelligent that we don't know, you tell me."
"The book's made some money already," he told her.
"That's wonderful. I'm so glad.
But we know it's good. If the reviews had said it was worthless and it never made a cent, I would have been just as proud and just as happy.
I wouldn't, the young man thought. But he did not say it. He went on reading the reviews, unfolding them and folding them up again and putting them back in the envelope. The girl sat opening envelopes and reading her letters without interest. Then she looked out of the cafe at the sea. Her face was a dark gold brown, and she had brushed her hair straight back from her forehead, the way the sea had pulled it when she had come out of the water, and where it was cropped close and on her cheeks, the sun had burned it to a white gold against the brown of her skin. She looked out at the sea and her eyes were very sad. Then she went back to opening letters. There was a long, typewritten one that she read with concentration. Then she went on opening and reading the other letters. The young man looked at her and thought she looked a little as though she were shelling peas. What was in the letters? The young man asked. There were checks in some.
Big ones?
Two.
That's fine, he said.
Don't go away like that. You always said it never made any difference.
Have I said anything?
No. He just went away.
I'm sorry, he said. How big are they?
Not much, really, but good for us. They've been deposited. It's because I'm married. I told you it was the best thing for us to be married. I know it doesn't mean anything as capital, but this is spendable. We can spend it, and it doesn't hurt anybody, and it's for that. It doesn't have anything to do with regular income, nor what I get if I live to be 25, or if I ever live to be 30. This is ours for anything we want to do. Neither of us will have to worry about balances for a while. It's that simple.
The book has paid back the advance and made about $1,000, he said.
Isn't that awfully good when it's only just come out?
It's all right.
Should we have another one of these? He asked.
Let's drink something else.
How much vermouth did you drink?
Only the one. I must say it was dull.
I drank two and didn't even taste them.
What is there that's real? She said.
Did you ever drink Armagnac and soda? That's real enough.
Good. Let's try that.
The waiter brought the Armagnac, and the young man told him to bring a cold bottle of Perrier water instead of the siphon. The waiter poured two large Armagnacs, and the young man put ice in the big glasses and poured in the Perrier.
This will fix us, he said. It's a hell of a thing to drink before lunch, though.
The girl took a long sip.
It's good, she said. It has a fresh, clean, healthy, ugly taste.
She took another long sip.
I can really feel it, can you?
Yes, he said, and took a deep breath. I can feel it.
She drank from the glass again and smiled, and the laugh wrinkles came at the corner of her eyes. The cold Perrier had made the heavy brandy alive.
For heroes, he said.
I don't mind being a hero, she said. We're not like other people. We don't have to call each other darling or my dear or my love, nor any of that to make a point. Darling and my dearest and my very dearest and all that are obscene to me, and we call each other by our Christian names. You know what I'm trying to say. Why do we have to do other things like everyone does?
You're a very intelligent girl.
All right, Davy, she said. Why do we have to be stuffy? Why don't we keep on and travel now when it can never be more fun? We'll do everything you want. If you'd been a European with a lawyer, my money would have been yours anyway. It is yours.
The hell with it.
All right, the hell with it. But we'll spend it, and I think it's wonderful. You can write afterwards. That way we can have the fun before I have a baby, for one thing. How do I know when I'll have a baby, even? Now it's all getting dull and dusty talking about it. Can't we just do it and not talk about it? What if I want to write?
The minute you're not going to do something, it will probably make you want to do it.
Then write, stupid. You didn't say you wouldn't write. Nobody said anything about worrying if you wrote, did they?
But somewhere something had been said, and now he could not remember it because he had been thinking ahead.
If you want to write, go ahead and I'll amuse myself. I don't have to leave you when you write, do I?
But where would you like us to go now when people begin to come here?
Anywhere you want to go. Will you do it, David?
For how long?
For as long as we want. 6 months, 9 months, a year.
All right, he said.
Really?
Sure.
You're awfully good. If I didn't love you for anything else, I'd love you for your decisions.
They're easy to make when you haven't seen how too many of them can turn out. He drank the hero drink, but it did not taste so good, and he ordered a fresh bottle of cold Perrier and made a short drink without ice.
Make me one, please, short like yours, and then let's let it start and have lunch.
Chapter 3. That night in bed when they were still awake, she said in the dark,
We don't always have to do the devil things either. Please know that.
I know.
I love it the way we were before, and I'm always your girl. Don't ever be lonely. You know that. I'm how you want, but I'm how I want too, and it isn't as though it wasn't for us both. You don't have to talk.
I'm only telling a story to put you to sleep because you're my good, lovely husband and my brother, too. I love you, and when we go to Africa, I'll be your African girl, too.
Are we going to Africa?
Aren't we? Don't you remember? That was what it was about today. So we could go there or anywhere. Isn't that where we're going?
Why didn't you say it?
I didn't want to interfere. I said wherever you wanted, I'd go anywhere. But I thought that was where you wanted.
It's too early to go to Africa now. It's the big rains, and afterwards the grass is too high, and it's very cold.
We could go to bed and keep warm and hear the rain on a tin roof.
No, it's too early. The roads turn to mud, and you can't get around, and everything is like a swamp, and the grass gets so tall you can't see.
Then where should we go?
We can go to Spain, but Sevilla is over. And so is San Isidro in Madrid, and it's too early for there, too. It's too early for the Basque coast. It's still cold and rainy. It rains everywhere there now.
Isn't there a hot part where we could swim the way we do here?
You can't swim in Spain the way we do here. You'd get arrested.
What a bore.
Let's wait to go there, then, because I want us to get darker.
Why do you want to be so dark?
I don't know. Why do you want anything?
Right now, it's the thing that I want most. That we don't have, I mean.
Doesn't it make you excited to have me getting so dark?
Uh-huh. I love it.
Did you think I could ever be this dark?
No, because you're blonde.
I can because I'm lion color and they can go dark. But I want every part of me dark. And it's getting that way. And you'll be darker than an Indian, and that takes us further away from other people. You see why it's important.
What will we be?
I don't know, maybe we'll just be us, only changed.
That's maybe the best thing.
And we will keep on, won't we?
Sure. We can go over by the Esterel and explore and find another place the way we found this one.
We can do that. There are lots of wild places and nobody is there in the summer.
We could get a car and then we could go everywhere.
Spain too, when we want. Once we're really dark, it won't be hard to keep unless we've had to live in towns. We don't want to be in towns in the summer.
How dark are you going to get?
As dark as I can. We'll have to see. I wish I had some Indian blood. I'm going to be so dark you won't be able to stand it. I can't wait to go up on the beach tomorrow.
She went to sleep that way with her head back and her chin up as though she were in the sun on the beach, breathing softly. And then she curled toward him on her side and the young man lay awake and thought about the day.
It is very possible that I couldn't get started, he thought. And it probably is sound to not think about it at all and just enjoy what we have.
When I have to work, I will. Nothing can stop that. The last book is good and I must make a better one now. This nonsense that we do is fun, although I don't know how much of it is nonsense and how much is serious. Drinking brandy at noon is no damn good, and already the simple aperitifs mean nothing. That is not a good sign. She changes from a girl into a boy and back to a girl carelessly and happily. She sleeps easily and beautifully, and you will sleep too because all you truly know is that you feel good. You did not sell anything for the money, he thought.
Everything she said about the money was true. Actually, it all was true. Everything was free for a time.
What was that she had said about destruction?
He could not remember that. She'd said it, but he could not remember it. Then he was tired of trying to remember, and he looked at the girl and kissed her cheek very lightly, and she did not wake. He loved her very much, and everything about her, and he went to sleep thinking about her cheek against his lips, and how the next day they would both be darker from the sun, and how dark can she become, he thought, and how dark will she ever really be?
Book 2 Chapter 4 It was late afternoon, and the small, low car came down from the black road across the hills and headlands, with the dark blue ocean always on the right, onto a deserted boulevard that bordered a flat beach of 2 miles of yellow sand at Ondé. Well ahead on the ocean side was the bulk of a big hotel and a casino, and on the left there were newly planted trees and Basque villas, whitewashed and brown-timbered, set in their own trees and plantings. The two young people in the car rode down the boulevard, slowly looking out at the magnificent beach and at the mountains of Spain that showed blue in this light as the car passed the casino and the big hotel and went on toward the end of the boulevard. Ahead was the mouth of the river that flowed into the ocean. The tide was out, and across the bright sand they saw the ancient Spanish town and the green hills across the bay and, at the far point, the lighthouse. They stopped the car.
It's a lovely place, the girl said.
There's a cafe with tables under the trees, the young man said. Old trees.
The trees are strange, the girl said. It's all new planting. I wonder why they planted mimosas.
To compete with where we've come from.
I suppose so. It all looks awfully new. But it's a wonderful beach. I never saw such a big beach in France. Nor with such smooth and fine sand. Biarritz is a horror. Let's drive up by the cafe.
They drove back up the right side of the road. The young man pulled the car to the curb and killed the ignition. They crossed to the outdoor cafe, and it was pleasant to eat by themselves and be conscious of the people that they did not know eating at the other tables. That night the wind rose, and in their corner room high up in the big hotel, they heard the heavy fall of the surf on the beach. In the dark, the young man pulled a light blanket up over the sheet, and the girl said,
"Aren't you glad we decided to stay?
I like to hear the surf pound."
"So do I."
They lay close together and listened to the sea. Her head was on his chest, and she moved it against his chin, and then moved up in the bed and put her cheek against his and pressed it there. She kissed him, and he could feel her hand touching him.
"That's good," she said in the darkness. "That's lovely. You sure you don't want me to change?"
"Not now. Now I'm cold. Please hold me warm.
I love you when you feel cold against me."
"If it gets this cold here at night, we'll have to wear pajama tops. That will be fun for breakfast in bed."
"It's the Atlantic Ocean," she said. "Listen to it."
"We'll have a good time while we're here," he told her. "If you want, we'll stay a while. If you want, we'll go. There are plenty of places to go."
"We might stay a few days and see."
"Good. If we do, I'd like to start to write."
"That would be wonderful. We'll look around tomorrow. You could work here in the room if I were out, couldn't you? Until we found some place?"
"Sure."
"You know, you must never worry about me, because I love you, and we're us against all the others. Please kiss me," she said.
He kissed her.
"You know I haven't done anything bad to us. I had to do it. You know that."
He did not say anything, and listened to the weight of the surf falling on the hard, wet sand in the night. The next morning there was still heavy surf, and the rain came in gusts. They could not see the Spanish coast, and when it cleared between the driven squalls of rain and they could see across the angry sea in the bay, there were heavy clouds that came down to the base of the mountains. Catherine had gone out in a raincoat after breakfast and had left him to work in the room. It had gone so simply and easily that he thought it was probably worthless. Be careful, he said to himself. It is all very well for you to write simply, and the simpler the better. But do not start to think so damned simply. Know how complicated it is, and then state it simply. Do you suppose the Gros de Roi time was all simple because you could write a little of it simply? He went on writing in pencil in the cheap, lined school notebook that was called a cahier, and already numbered 1 in Roman numeral. He stopped finally and put the notebook in a suitcase with a cardboard box of pencils and the cone-shaped sharpener, leaving the 5 pencils he had dulled to point up for the next day, and took his raincoat from the hanger in the closet and walked down the stairs to the lobby of the hotel. He looked into the hotel bar, which was gloomy and pleasant in the rain, and already had some customers, and left his key at the desk. The assistant concierge reached into the mailbox as he hung up the key and said, Madame left this for monsieur. He opened the note which said, David, didn't want to disturb you, am at the cafe, love, Catherine. He put on the old trench coat, found a bowina in the pocket, and walked out of the hotel into the rain. She was at a corner table in the small cafe, and before her was a clouded, yellow-tinged drink and a plate with 1 small, dark, red freshwater crayfish and the debris of others. She was very far ahead of him. Where have you been, stranger? Just down the road a piece. He noticed that her face was rain-washed, and he concentrated on what rain did to heavily tanned skin. She looked very nice, too, in spite of it, and he was happy to see her this way. Did you get going? The girl asked. Good enough. You worked then, that's fine. The waiter had been serving 3 Spaniards who were sitting at a table next to the door. He came over now holding a glass and an ordinary Pernod bottle and a small, narrow-lipped pitcher of water. There were lumps of ice in the water. Pour monsieur aussi? He asked. Yes, the young man said. Please. The waiter poured their high glasses half full of the off-yellow liquid and started to pour the water slowly into the girl's glass. But the young man said, I'll do it. And the waiter took the bottle away. He seemed relieved to be taking it away, and the young man poured the water in a very thin stream, and the girl watched the absinthe cloud opalescently. It felt warm as her fingers held the glass, and then it lost the yellow cast and began to look milky. It cooled sharply, and the young man let the water fall in a drop at a time. Why does it have to go in so slowly? The girl asked. It breaks up and goes to pieces if the water pours in too fast, he explained. Then it's flat and worthless. There ought to be a glass on top with ice and just a little hole for the water to drip. But everybody would know what it was then. I had a drink up fast before because 2 GNs were in, the girl said. GNs? Whatchamacallit's nationals, in khaki with bicycles and black leather pistol holsters. I had to engulf the evidence.
Engulf?
Sorry. Once I engulfed it, I can't say it. You want to be careful about absinthe. It only makes me feel easier about things.
And nothing else does?
He finished making the absinthe for her, holding it well short of mildness.
Go ahead, he told her. Don't wait for me.
She took a long sip, and then he took her glass from her and drank and said, Thank you, ma'am.
That puts heart in a man.
So make your own, you clipping reader, she said.
What was that? The young man said to her.
I didn't say it.
But she had said it, and he said to her,
Why don't you just shut up about the clippings?
Why? She said, leaning toward him and speaking too loudly.
Why should I shut up? Just because you wrote this morning? Do you think I married you because you're a writer? You and your clippings.
All right, the young man said. Can you tell me the rest of it when we're by ourselves?
Don't ever think for a moment I won't, she said.
I guess not, he said.
Don't guess, she said. You can be certain.
David Bourne stood up and went over to the hangar and lifted his raincoat and went out the door without looking back. At the table, Catherine raised her glass and tasted the absinthe very carefully and went on tasting it in little sips. The door opened and David came back in and walked up to the table. He was wearing his trench coat and had his boina pulled low on his forehead. "Do you have the keys to the car?"
"Yes," she said.
"May I have them?"
She gave them to him, but said, "Don't be stupid, David. It was the rain, and you being the only one who'd worked. Sit down."
"Do you want me to?"
"Please," she said.
He sat down. That didn't make much sense, he thought. You got up to go out and take the damn car and stay out in the hell with her, and then you came back in and have to ask for the key and then sit down like a slob.
He picked up his glass and took a drink. The drink was good, anyway.
"What are you going to do about lunch?" he asked.
"You say where and I'll eat with you. You do still love me, don't you?"
"Don't be silly."
"That was a sordid quarrel," Catherine said.
"The first one, too.
It was my fault about the clippings."
"Let's not mention the goddamn clippings."
"That's what it was all about.
It was you thinking about them when you were drinking, bringing them up because you were drinking."
"Sounds like regurgitating," she said. "Awful. Actually, my tongue just slipped making a joke."
"You had to have them in your head to bring them out that way."
"All right," she said. "I thought maybe it was all over."
"It is."
"But what do you keep on insisting and insisting about it for, then?"
"We shouldn't have taken this drink."
"No, of course not, especially me. But you certainly needed it. Do you think it will do you any good?"
"Do we have to do this now?" he asked.
"I'm certainly going to stop it. It bores me.
That's the one damn word in the language I can't stand."
"Lucky you with only one word like that in the language."
"Oh, shit," he said. "Eat lunch by yourself."
"No, I won't. We'll eat lunch."